Chapter 37. Illuminated the closet, and, the door being closed, a dim ray streamed through the keyhole. A kind of twilight was thus created sufficient for the purposes of vision, but, at the same time, involving all minute objects in obscurity. This darkness suited the color of my thoughts. I sickened at the remembrance of the past. The prospect of the future excited my loathing. I muttered, in a low voice, "Why should I live longer? Why should I drag a miserable being? All for whom I ought to live have perished. Am I not myself hunted to death?" At that moment my despair suddenly became vigorous. My nerves were no longer unstrung. My powers, that had long been deadened, were revived. My bosom swelled with a sudden energy, and the conviction darted through my mind that to end my torments was, at once, practicable and wise. I knew how to find way to the recesses of life. I could use a lancet with some skill, and could distinguish between vein and artery. By piercing deep into the latter, I should shun the evils which the future had in store for me, and take refuge from my woes in quiet death. I started on my feet, for my feebleness was gone, and hasted to the closet. A lancet and other small instruments were preserved in a case which I had deposited here. Inattentive as I was to foreign considerations, my ears were still open to any sound of mysterious import that should occur. I thought I heard a step in the entry. My purpose was suspended, and I cast an eager glance at my chamber door, which was open. No one appeared, unless the shadow which I discerned upon the floor was the outline of a man. If it were, I was authorized to suspect that someone was posted close to the entrance, who possibly had overheard my exclamations. My teeth chattered, and a wild confusion took the place of my momentary calm. Thus it was when a terrific visage had disclosed itself on a former night. Thus it was when the evil destiny of Wieland assumed the lineaments of something human. What horrid apparition was preparing to blast my sight? Still I listened and gazed. Not long, for the shadow moved. A foot, unshapely and huge, was thrust forward. A form advanced from its concealment, and stalked into the room. It was Carwin. While I had breath, I shrieked. While I had power over my muscles, I motioned with my hand that he should vanish. My exertions could not last long. I sunk into a fit. Oh, that this grateful oblivion had lasted forever! Too quickly I recovered my senses. The power of distinct vision was no sooner restored to me than this hateful form again presented itself, and I once more relapsed. A second time, untoward nature recalled me from the sleep of death. I found myself stretched upon the bed. When I had power to look up, I remembered only that I had cause to fear. My distempered fancy fashioned to itself no distinguishable image. I threw a languid glance round me. Once more my eyes lighted upon Carwin. He was seated on the floor, his back rested against the wall, his knees were drawn up, and his face was buried in his hands. That his station was at some distance, that his attitude was not menacing, that his ominous visage was concealed, may account for my now escaping a shock violent as those which were past. I withdrew my eyes, but was not again deserted by my senses. On perceiving that I had recovered my sensibility, he lifted his head. This motion attracted my attention. His countenance was mild, but sorrow and astonishment sat upon his features. I averted my eyes and feebly exclaimed, "Oh, fly, fly far and forever! I cannot behold you and live!" He did not rise upon his feet, but clasped his hands, and said, in a tone of deprecation, "I will fly. I am become a fiend, the sight of whom destroys. Yet tell me my offense. You have linked curses with my name. You ascribe to me a malice monstrous and infernal. I look around. All is loneliness and desert. This house and your brothers are solitary and dismantled. You die away at the sight of me. My fear whispers that some deed of horror has been perpetrated, that I am the undesigning cause." What language was this? Had he not avowed himself a ravisher? Had not this chamber witnessed his atrocious purposes? I besought him with new vehemence to go. He lifted his eyes. Reet heaven! What have I done? I think I know the extent of my offenses. I have acted, but my actions have possibly affected more than I designed. This fear has brought me back from my retreat. I come to repair the evil, of which my rashness was the cause, and to prevent more evil. I come to confess my errors. Wretch! I cried, when my suffocating emotions would permit me to speak, the ghosts of my sister and her children, do they not rise to accuse thee? Who was it that blasted the intellect of Wyland? Who was it that urged him to fury and guided him to murder? Who, but thou and the devil, with whom thou art confederated? At these words a new spirit pervaded his countenance. His eyes once more appealed to heaven. If I have memory, if I have, being I am innocent. I intended no ill, but my folly, indirectly and remotely, may have caused it. But what words are these? Your brother lunatic. His children dead. What should I infer from this deportment? Was the ignorance which these words implied real or pretended? Yet how could I imagine a mere human agency in these events? But, if the influence was preternatural, or maniacal in my brother's case, they must be equally so in my own. Then I remembered that the voice exerted was to save me from Carwin's attempts. These ideas tended to abate my abhorrence of this man, and to detect the absurdity of my accusations. Alas! Said I have no one to accuse. Leave me to my fate. Fly from a scene stained with cruelty, devoted to despair. Carwin stood for a time musing and mournful. At length he said, What has happened? I came to expiate my crimes. Let me know them in their full extent. I have horrible forebodings. What has happened? I was silent, but, recollecting the intimation given by this man, when he was detected in my closet, which implied some knowledge of that power which interfered in my favor, I eagerly inquired, what was that voice which called upon me to hold when I attempted to open the closet? What face was that which I saw at the bottom of the stairs? Answer me truly. I came to confess the truth. Your illusions are horrible and strange. Perhaps I have but faint conceptions of the evils which my infatuation has produced. But what remains I will perform. It was my voice that you heard. It was my face that you saw. For a moment I doubted whether my remembrance of events were not confused. How could he be at once stationed at my shoulder and shut up in my closet? How could he stand near me and yet be invisible? But if Carwin's were the thrilling voice, and the fiery image which I had heard and seen, then was he the prompter of my brother, and the author of these dismal outrages. Once more I averted my eyes and struggled for speech. Egan! Thou man of mischief! Remorseless and implacable miscreant, Began! I will obey, said he, in a disconsolate voice. Yet, wretch as I am I unworthy to repair the evils that I have committed? I came as a repentant criminal. It is you whom I have injured, and at your bar, am I willing to appear and confess, and expiate my crimes? I have deceived you, I have sported with your terrors, I have plotted to destroy your reputation. I come now to remove your terrors, to set you beyond the reach of similar fears, to rebuild your fame as far as I am able. This is the amount of my guilt, and this the fruit of my remorse. Will you not hear me? Listen to my confession, and then denounce punishment. All I ask is a patient audience. What? I replied. Was not thine the voice that commanded my brother to imbrue his hands in the blood of his children? To strangle that angel of sweetness, his wife? Has he not vowed my death, and the death of Pleyel, at thy bidding? Hast thou not made him the butcher of his family? Changed him who was the glory of his species into worse than brute? Robbed him of reason, and consigned the rest of his days to fetters and stripes? Carwin's eyes glared and his limbs were petrified at this intelligence. No words were requisite to prove him guiltless of these enormities. At the time, however, I was nearly insensible to these exculpatory tokens. He walked to the farther end of the room, and, having recovered some degree of composure, he spoke. I am not this villain. I have slain no one. I have prompted none to slay. I have handled a tool of wonderful efficacy without malignant intentions, but without caution. Ample will be the punishment of my temerity, if my conduct has contributed to this evil. He paused. I likewise was silent. I struggled to command myself so far as to listen to the tale which he should tell. Observing this, he continued. You are not apprised of the existence of a power which I possess. I know not by what name to call it. One, it enables me to mimic exactly the voice of another, and to modify the sound, so that it shall appear to come from what quarter, and be uttered at what distance I please. I know not that everyone possesses this power. Perhaps, though a casual position of my organs, in my youth showed me, that I possessed it, it is an art which may be taught to all. Would to God I had died unknowing of the secret. It has produced nothing but degradation and calamity. 1. Biloquium, Irventrilocution. Sound is varied according to the variations of direction and distance. The art of the ventriloquist consists in modifying his voice according to all these variations, without changing his place. See the work of the Abbé de la Chapelle, in which are accurately recorded the performances of one of these artists, and some ingenious, though unsatisfactory speculations are given on the means by which the effects are produced. This power is, perhaps, given by nature, but is doubtless improvable, if not acquirable, by art. It may, possibly, consist in an unusual flexibility or extension of the bottom of the tongue and the uvula. That speech is producible by these alone must be granted, since anatomists mention two instances of persons speaking without a tongue. In one case the organ was originally wanting, but its place was supplied by a small tubercle, and the uvula was perfect. In the other the tongue was destroyed by disease, but probably a small part of it remained. This power is difficult to explain, but the fact is undeniable. Experience shows that the human voice can imitate the voice of all men, and of all inferior animals. The sound of musical instruments, and even noises from the contact of inanimate substances, have been accurately imitated. The mimicry of animals is notorious, and Dr. Burney Musical Travels mentions one who imitated a flute and violin, so as to deceive even his ears. Third part. After Carwin's confession of his powers of ventriloquism, all the mysteries are cleared up save one. The owner of the voice heard in Clara's chamber, on the first night after the wanderer appeared at Mettingen, the threatener on the edge of the precipice, the spy in Clara's closet, and would-be intruder, the manipulator of the vile plot that destroyed her lover's confidence, all these hidden identities have materialized in the person of this one unhappy man. But while confessing the prying disposition which led to these sins, in efforts to protect himself from discovery, Carwin still denies that Wieland's mad acts were perpetrated at his instigation. I have uttered the truth. This is the extent of my offenses. You tell me a horrid tale of Wieland being led to the destruction of his wife and children by some mysterious agent. You charge me with the guilt of this agency, but I repeat that the amount of my guilt has been truly stated. The perpetrator of Catherine's death was unknown to me till now, nay, it is still unknown to me. At that moment, the closing of a door in the kitchen was distinctly heard by us. Carwin started and paused. Here is someone coming. I must not be found here by my enemies, and need not, since my purpose is answered. I had drunk in, with the most vehement attention, every word that he had uttered. I had no breath to interrupt his tale by interrogations or comments. The power that he spoke of was hitherto unknown to me. Its existence was incredible. It was susceptible of no direct proof. He owns that his were the voice and face which I heard and saw. He attempts to give a human explanation of these phantasms, but it is enough, that he owns himself to be the agent. His tale is a lie, and his nature devilish. As he deceived me, he likewise deceived my brother, and now do I behold the author of all our calamities. Such were my thoughts, when his pause allowed me to think. I should have bade him beckon, if the silence had not been interrupted. But now I feared, no more for myself, and the milkiness of my nature was curdled into hatred and rancor. Someone was near, and this enemy of God and man might possibly be brought to justice. I reflected not that the preternatural power which he had hitherto exerted would avail to rescue him from any toils in which his feet might be entangled. Meanwhile, looks, and not words, of menace and abhorrence, were all that I could bestow. He did not depart. He seemed dubious, whether by passing out of the house, or by remaining somewhat longer where he was, he should most endanger his safety. His confusion increased when steps of one barefoot were heard upon the stairs. He threw anxious glances sometimes at the closet, sometimes at the window, and sometimes at the chamber door, yet he was detained by some inexplicable fascination. He stood as if rooted to the spot. As to me, my soul was bursting with detestation and revenge. I had no room for surmises and fears respecting him that approached. It was doubtless a human being, and would befriend me so far as to aid me in arresting this offender. The stranger quickly entered the room. My eyes and the eyes of Carwin were at the same moment darted upon him. A second glance was not needed to inform us who he was. His locks were tangled, and fell confusedly over his forehead and ears. His shirt was of coarse stuff, and open at the neck and breast. His coat was once of bright and fine texture, but now torn and tarnished with dust. His feet, his legs, and his arms were bare. His features were the seat of a wild and tranquil solemnity, but his eyes bespoke inquietude and curiosity. He advanced with a firm step, and looking as in search of someone. He saw me and stopped. He bent his sight on the floor, and, clenching his hands, appeared suddenly absorbed in meditation. Such were the figure and deportment of Wieland. Such, in his Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.